There's a town in England that had a wisdom that we could have profited from in the United States. 75 years ago, they saw the threat to their environment, and as a town, they started taking steps to ward it off. They had a meeting to see what they could do to keep their air, their water, their soil clean. At the start of the meeting, they recognized that the single greatest threat to the quality of their living was the combustion engine, and they banned it from that day to this, and it doesn't make any difference whether you live there or visit there. No combustion engine is allowed in the town. No bus, no car, no truck, no cycle, no van. Their problem, and they spent the whole day debating it, was when we ban the combustion engine, what are we going to use for transportation? And they looked at all the possibilities, and at the end of the day, by a very close vote, they settled on what they've used for 75 years. They've settled on the donkey. It's crucial to their way of life. They needed to transport their goods. They needed to transport themselves. And so if you go to town and you get up close and you look, you'll find that the senior man in town has his own ass. The senior lady in town has her own ass. If you look carefully enough, you'll find that every young gal in town has her own ass. Now, considering how important the ass is to life, people are driving their ass and pushing their ass and pushing their ass. And if you push your ass too hard and too far, it's going to break down on you. Very quickly, people find their problems backing up on them. And so naturally, they borrow somebody else's ass. Now, in your whole life, has anybody else's ass ever moved fast enough for you? So you try to help it along. Few kicks here, few kicks there. People don't like to have their ass kicked by strangers in public. And this leads to a lot of fights. Once a year, because of how central the ass is to the life of this town, everybody parades their ass in public. And they pick the best looking ass in town. Now, asses may differ, but politicians don't. And that day, you'll find the local mayor kissing ass for votes. Come Sunday morning, everybody has to haul their ass off and go to church. There is a particular Sunday that underlies what I'm sharing with you. And right in the middle of the Catholic Mass, an earthquake struck the town. Well, naturally, everybody ran out of church to save their ass. Except for the priest. He had parked his ass on the side of the church, tying it to a tree, and he noticed that all of the windows there were broken by the quake, and being real smart, he thought he would just jump through a window and land on his ass. What he didn't know is that was exactly where the great crevice of the earthquake struck. And as he jumped through the window, he fell in the crevice, proving that even a priest can't tell his ass from a hole in the ground. I'm Larry Kowalski, and I'm an alcoholic. Boy, it's missed y'all for a long time. Thank you. Because this program works, and I'm from Texas, Oklahoma, and my sponsor tells me to do it, I give a sobriety date. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-changing chemical today or any today since May the 21st, 1972. It's not something I share. I know why I do it, and I leave people with a lot of confusion, and I've had a question on it. I am a Catholic priest. I got here precisely, so that story wasn't selected by accident. It describes the how and the whys of my arrival at Alcoholics Anonymous. I am pastor of one of the larger parishes in my archdiocese, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. I do not wear clerical clothing, and I do not use the title in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this at all. The reason is, the first reason I had was when I sobered up, we had a Colonel John in my group until he got drunk and he came back as John. And I realized that anything that separates me from the fellowship can kill me. About 5 years ago, I worked into a far richer reason. This is only the second place in my life where I have felt accepted. And I don't want to be accepted because of what I do. I need to be accepted for who I am. And so I would appreciate if you ever deal with me in Alcoholics Anonymous that you call me Larry, and that's who I am. If you deal with me through the church, there is a respect sometimes that should be shown the position, and so I expect the title there, but it's more not for me, it's just for the church itself. I want to thank the committee for inviting me here very much. I've been here from the start. I missed only one meeting, and I'm not going to be able to talk on every talk I've heard. I want to thank some of the speakers. I've made friends of some of the speakers. I just, Jeannie with the twinkle in her eye just helped me relax as I was here. I don't often do this, but because of your responsibilities of life, most of you wouldn't be able to have arrived here to hear Lamar on Thursday night. I have a tape library of, I think, over 500 speakers. And I've been honored to be in a lot of different places and hear a lot of talks. Thursday night, I heard for me one of the three finest AA talks I've ever heard. I strongly urge you to get it because it is so spiritual. And obviously, when I looked at the man and saw the twinkle, it wasn't a message, it was a sharing of a person. And he did talk on the theme, A Design for Living. I used to feel very, very nervous because I would stand up here and wonder how I could give something to every one of you. And one of my great AAs shared with me the new philosophy I have had on what I'm doing here. And when the committee asked me to come here, that is God guaranteeing me that there's some one person out there today that needs what I'm going to share. And if I share my story, I'm offering what that person needs. If I don't share my story, I'll be cheating that person. I share my story sometimes a little differently than others, but I hope you'll be able to go along with what I'm going to do. The rest of you, I hope, can get something. But I'm going to talk to the dandelion out here today. I have found a God through the program. I'll jump ahead and say, oh, incidentally, 23 years ago today, I was ordained a priest. And that's when my alcoholism exploded. And it was by accident this morning that it occurred to me, this is the anniversary of my ordination. And I hope I will be able to share that with you. I was totally frustrated and empty inside. And for years I had lived with the dream that if only I become a priest, then I'll be happy. And I had to walk through the pain of knowing when I'm frustrated and became a priest, I became a frustrated priest. And at that point, there were no more dreams. There was just alcohol. And I leaned on it totally. But I want to back up a little bit. I want to tell you why I want to talk about a dandelion. I found my God through the program. I was an atheist as a priest when I got here. I stowed every cent that was in the poor fund of the church where I was for the first 3 years. And I didn't do it for alcohol. I had the wine supply as a backup when I needed it. I've done street drugs. I didn't use it for the drugs that I did. I had a private supply of those. I did it for other outlets of this same inner pain I was feeling. I found my God here. I was very slow in calling what I experienced God. I woke up 2 weeks in the program with a peace that I had never had in my life. It was okay in the deepest level of being Larry to be Larry. And I wasn't going to get any labels on it because this worked. And very slowly, this became a series of coincidences that were all designed to help me. And I've just had a powerful new set of coincidences explode in my life. I'm in a new plateau of growth. I've just come out of a cocoon. And I have more serenity and more peace and more growth facing me than I've ever had in my life, than I've ever dreamt I could have in my life. But anyway, 2 weeks sober, it was okay to be Larry. And the coincidences told me that whatever this power was personal. And I just am explaining to you my definition of terms. A personal power greater than me I call God. But it still wasn't the God of any church, because I wasn't going to push it. I let it happen. And it took about 2 years before what I had here was what I also celebrate in church. And for 20 years, I find my God in AA, and then when it gets great, I go to church and celebrate it. And that's the way I walk it, and it's worked very, very well for me. I told you I want to talk about dandelions. My God wanted to plant a garden. And you could make the garden about just the size of that little white table. And in there, he wanted to select different shapes and colors and sizes so that he would have in that garden a perfect work of art of nature. And he got everything done but one little spot. And in that spot, he wanted gold and he wanted petals and he had a shape that he thought would just be neat. And he created the dandelion. Unfortunately, my world labels the dandelion a weed. And I'm that dandelion. And so I grew up trying to be a tulip in shape. And when you're a dandelion, there is no design of living that will ever allow you to live as a tulip. Maybe there was for you, but there isn't for me. My world did not want me to be golden. And so I tried to be red. And when the bud can only open up to be golden, there is no design for living that would enable me to come out red. And I felt the stress and the strain. And I could go on and explain this a little bit more. But I want to tell you the particulars of what I'm talking about. At the age of 7, and I have a picture that I can show you, had ears that stood out exactly like this and were about this big in proportion to my head. I went through first grade with a cousin with whom I'm still very close, and she still remembers the pain that I got from everybody laughing and calling me Dumbo and Big Ears. 10 years sober, I'm 55 years old now. 10 years sober, 35 years old. 45 years old, I'm also bad on math. I had never pictured my face that I was aware of in my life. My mind blotted out what I looked like. I had a cyst grow in the center of my forehead and I missed it for months. It got so large. Because when I shaved, I blocked out what was in the mirror. Because you see, I felt ugly. I still felt my ears were way out here. I've never had plastic surgery. My dad was a coal miner. I don't know when I grew into my ears because I blocked out my looks and I felt ugly and I denied that reality. However you want to share it, I had a shape that I wasn't supposed to have. And there literally is lack of power. That was our dilemma. There is no power that I know that when I am shaped one way will allow me to be shaped another way. From the first moment I have never felt I've had a right to live. I've never felt good inside. I never felt I belong. And so I would have to try to be perfect. I never felt I was part of your world, that the world in which I live wanted me. And feeling this, feeling like a dandelion in a bed of tulips, there's no power that I knew that could enable me to become a tulip so that I would belong with you. At the age of 16, I concluded that I would end my life permanently committed to a mental hospital. I don't think it was a wrong decision given the strain and the pain that I was living in. And I hated my whole way of thinking. And again, there was no power that would allow me, given the pressures and the drives and the urges and the actions that I had inside that I couldn't live with, to take my inside feelings and allow me to look like what your outside views look like. Especially when I only made the comparison when I was hating myself. My insides could never become your outsides. The single biggest thing I've become aware of lately is, through a series of strange accidents, I was absolutely emotionally abandoned for most of my life. My mother pushed us outdoors. She had her own emotional problems. She had no time for us. She would get the house perfect and then she would allow us in, and she never got the house perfect. She had no time for me. My mother was a strong, domineering woman. My dad could best be a man outside that home. He was a very strong, eruptive man. He was gone all the time. My mother pushed us outside. She abandoned me. My father emotionally abandoned me. I remember my mother hugging me once. I don't ever remember a deep talk with my mother. I remember one talk with my father, and it was to explaining why we were going to college. From the first grade on, it was just, I had to go to college. And I had that talk right before I became a senior at Penn State. The only talk I've ever had with my dad. There was nobody my age in my neighborhood. Nobody's ever paid attention to me. We had a great Al-Anon speaker who died recently in Oklahoma, Ramona, and she talked about the loneliness of onlyness. And having heard her share that, once I got up and I had to say at a conference where we were together, I felt something worse, and it's the loneliness of nothingness. Being only is being special and it's being noticed. Being nothing is having no one in your world pay any attention and feeling you don't deserve it as a result of this. And when I felt like this, there was literally no power that I thought existed that could allow me to become something and someone. And that's basically how I lived. My life was a life of fantasy because it was the only place that I knew where there wasn't pain. I grew up outside a Polish ghetto, and I went to school in that ghetto, and every other person in my class knew each other around the clock, and I came in from the outside, and I was a year younger than any of them, and so I was really never accepted. I wasn't paid any attention to. You know, it's bad to be the last one selected for a baseball team. It's worse not to be picked. And see, I was to a Catholic school before organized sports, and nobody wanted me because I couldn't do anything. And I was programmed to think I was a total failure. And I'm here today. I am not crazy and I am not dead because I was both suicidal and I was borderline psychotic and clearly deeply neurotic. I'm here today because I found the only great friend in my life before AA. I found alcohol. And if you're an Al-Anon, maybe you need to understand this. Alcohol is the solution to my disease of alcoholism. It was the power that allowed the dandelion to exist in a world where the dandelion felt it was to be a tulip and not know pain. When I drank, physically I belonged. My physical feelings were so deep that I never ever felt that I was attractive the way some people feel. But it's as if when I drank, there was an inner glow that you saw in me, and you wouldn't look at the outer physical ugliness. And so I was okay. And when I drank, I went instantly from being not okay to being okay. I went instantly from being a weed that you didn't want in your garden to someone who belonged in the garden of your life. And that was neat. And when I drank, I wasn't going to end my life in a mental hospital. As a matter of fact, when I was seeing my own psychiatrist drinking, I was counseling people and playing psychiatrist. And I wonder today at the damage that I did. I'm alcoholic from the first drink. I loved it. I never enjoyed the taste, but I loved the effect. I needed the effect. I went to St. Mary's Seminary in Roland Park, Packer Street in Roland Park, Baltimore. Let me tell you about my alcoholism, and maybe this will help some of you identify. I have 12 years of schooling. I have about 400 some credits. It's the only area where I felt I belonged. I did well academically. And 2 years ago, I was driving about 3 hours one way to give an AA talk in my own state, and I started thinking about my life. And this is 17 years sober, and all of a sudden, for the first time, it occurred to me that when I go to colleges, I go to Penn State, the only memories I have are memories focused centered around drinking. I graduated not being old enough to drink in my own state. The drinking age was 21, and I graduated right before my 21st birthday. So all of my drinking at Penn State was illegal. I couldn't go to state stores, and I couldn't go to bars. I needed fraternity parties. And I can tell you every fraternity party I went to. And then I graduated from there, and I went to the University of Wisconsin to start graduate school. And I spent a semester studying under the man who was the greatest authority in the world in the field that I was interested in, constitutional law. I had a fellowship there. And I don't remember anything about graduate school, any of those joys, even though I love to learn. I can tell you the first bar and where it was where I could drink legally in my life, discovering steins of beer and wine coolers. And then I decided to become a priest, and I went to Loyola in Chicago to study Latin to get into the seminary. And I spent a semester in Loyola of Chicago. And the only thing I can tell you about that semester is directly across the street from my room was a liquor store where I bought bottles of wine and kept them outside on my ledge to chill in the Chicago cool. Now, if you went to an earth person, that's what we call them in Oklahoma, and you asked them to talk about 12 years of college, they're not just going to come up with memories that deal with alcohol. But you see, I understand why today that's what occurred to me. Those were the only moments when the dandelion could live at peace. Every non-alcoholic moment, I had pain, I had tension, I had feelings of guilt, I had feelings of being the wrong color, the wrong shape, the wrong size, the wrong everything. And when I drank, I could be in your world. So those are the only unpleasant memories that my mind will remember. I went to the seminary in Baltimore, and I went in the old Catholic church, and if you're not Catholic, don't worry. You probably celebrated it sometimes. But I went in the old Catholic church where we'd have been thrown out if we had a drop of liquor on our breath ever through the year. And they let us out in Baltimore about only 6 days a year from 10 in the morning till 10 at night. And I drank everything I could, and I came in trying to stand as far away from the rector so he wouldn't see me reeling and he wouldn't smell the booze. But I understand why I did that. I risked everything I wanted, but first, alcoholism was already rearing its head, and I've never been a controlled drinker. I have never put a glass down and walked away from it. And I really liked so much what we heard last night about, you know, that the guy who's just nursing the drink. I watched somebody nurse a drink today, and I want to punch him in the face. I do. I'm 20 years sober. I don't like anybody sipping. You drink the stuff. Get it in. Get the explosion going. That's life. Start living. It doesn't act like that for them, but see, that's the only experience that I have that I know. I was thrown out of the sim, as I told you, and I started teaching in a seminary high school in Baltimore, and I got an apartment in the Roland Park area. And I got this bar where I did all this drinking. Now, the reason I did all this drinking in this bar is because that's where I did my laundry. There was a laundromat right across the street. And I got to be real friends with the waitress there, and I was drinking Michelob, and she charged me for every beer I ordered, but for every one I ordered, after she started liking me and I was leaving nice tips, she'd give me a free one. And I remember, I forgot which birthday it was, but I was running down to the bus station to get a bus back to Pennsylvania, and I had 12 bottles of Michelob undrunk that had lined up, the ones I ordered and the ones that she was bringing, that I had a down before I got to the bus station. I remember also it is during my only innocent drunk occurred in Baltimore. I was throwing a party and I was drinking rum and coke in glasses this big, and it'd be this much rum and that much coke. And I ran out of rum. And I know exactly where that liquor store is. This is like almost 30 years ago. Well, I don't know if the liquor store is still there, but I know where it is. If, you know, I can find it from my home, I could get to where that building is. And I went tearing in there to get a replacement bottle of rum while the party was going on. And I didn't know rum came in two strengths. I was always drinking that weaker stuff, and I got that 150 proof for rum and took it back, and I was drinking these whole, you know, the whole body, and got, that's an innocent drunk. Smashed out of my mind. Smashed out of my mind, and just great. If you want to know, now this is before I would consider the alcoholism to have gotten bad. I went into a creme de menthe stage where I drank creme de menthe for about 3 days until I noticed that everything leaving my body was tainted green. Okay, everything. So we were done with creme de menthe and went back to things like Southern Comfort. And the one thing I was never able to do was drink anything straight, like unless it was a sweet drink like Southern Comfort. And the more power anything packed, the better it was. But you see, alcohol worked. It was my design for living. And it enabled me to live. It was not a power that led me astray. It helped me to do most of those 12 years of college. It helped me confront people. It helped me handle the fears. It helped me handle the ugliness. It helped me handle the loneliness. And the single biggest thing was it made a bridge from me to you. And when I told you you're the second group I belonged with, the first group and the only group I know I belonged with before AA in my life was a group that I drank with in a bar in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Hazleton, at the age of 17. I was not an outsider trying to be part of that group. And alcohol did not drug me so that I thought I belonged to a group in which I didn't belong. I belonged to that group, and it was only through the power of alcohol I had a design of living for that one day of my life. And as long as alcohol was working, my design of living worked very well, and I did not mind that it got out of control. I've blacked out early. I blacked out all the time my last 2 or 3 years of drinking, and they were simply painful memories I didn't have to remember. And if it were simply the blackouts and the shakes, I wouldn't be here today. But the reason I'm here today is my design for living started failing me. I couldn't stop drinking, and all of a sudden, drunk, I felt more like a dandelion, uglier, lonelier, crazier than I did sober. And the best way to show this to you will be the progression that happened physically, socially. I told you that early in my drinking, alcohol made me part of life. Then when I got ordained, that's when it exploded. I was still drinking socially my first year after my ordination. Alcohol put me back in the world. As a matter of fact, I did a lot of drinking in Lawton, Oklahoma. It's a military town, in a bar called the Purple Bunny Club. Now, I'm going to tell you why I drank in the Purple Bunny Club. It's because I'm a good guy. And I was in a military town as people were coming back from Vietnam. And even in my sickness, I could touch their pain, and they needed to talk. But now my sickness takes over, and I thought that they would be very uncomfortable coming to the coldness of a parish office and talking to me. And they would be much more relaxed if we went to the Purple Bunny Club and they bought the drinks and screamed their problems at me over the sets of music, and I screamed the counseling back at them because the music was real loud. You want to know how much I was drinking in those days? I drank the maraschino cherry bar jar empty. I was drinking Manhattans in those days, and they just kept coming, bringing them one after another, and then went on drinking and had about 6 more after that. That's as far as I remembered that night, and I don't know how much I had following that. But I drank in public, and then all of a sudden, I wasn't drinking in public. I was drinking with a priest. The house where a priest lives in the Catholic Church we call a rectory, for those of you who may not know the term. I was drinking with another priest in the rectory. And then in stage 2, I was drinking alone in the rectory. And then in stage 3, I was drinking upstairs in my room in the rectory. And then in stage 4, which was where I was when I came here, I was drinking alone upstairs in my room with the door closed and the shades down and a television on and a book in my hand, because I was the only person in that room, but I couldn't stand the person in that room. And I needed something to distract me from being me. I couldn't stop drinking. Alcohol was causing troubles in my life. I felt worse drunk than I felt sober. And then I came to the program. This, about 2 weeks ago, I heard this. And let it be like a second story on which I want to fashion what I'm sharing with you. A man saw a big empty lot, but there was a lot of construction work going on, and he walked up to somebody and he said, "What are you doing?" And the man picked up a brick and he put it down amidst the mortar and he said, I'm laying a brick. And he walked a little further and he saw another man and he asked him, what are you doing? The man picked a brick up and he laid it down in the midst of some mortar and he said, I'm making a wall. And he walked a little bit further and he came to a woman and he asked her, what are you doing? And she picked a brick up and she put it down in the midst of some mortar and she said, I'm building a cathedral. I'd like you to think about that. That story has just astounded me. I have spent much of my AA time laying bricks. I've spent other days in AA making walls to shield me from alcohol, not to shield me from others. Today I want to tell you, I'm building a cathedral. And it's just a great, great, great place to be because I've had astounding things happen. When the alcohol went out of my life, that was no blessing. Someone told me this, if you've been here a while, this will have power. Supposing we put you in a straitjacket the day you came to AA, and that's all we did was get you to stop drinking from that day to this. I'd be crazy. I'd have to be. See, I wouldn't be able to kill myself, which would have been the other way of escape. And so I'd have escaped into my mind and to deny reality. I was talking to Lamar. On my 20th birthday, I was as humble as I've ever been in AA because it occurred to me, literally, the millions of alcoholics who have died from the day I came into the program. And if you were here your second day, alcoholics died yesterday, and you're still sober today. And I don't know anything that I've ever done, because I had just about every blessing I could picture, in one sense, in my life compared to other people. I don't know what I did to deserve this, because I took these blessings and I slapped God in the face with them and I cursed him and didn't believe in them. And yet I was still given the gift of sobriety. We don't appreciate this. Pardon me for just a little bit of lecturing, but I'm used to giving sermons on Sunday mornings. Just, if my sponsor hears this, I'll get my butt kicked. Because he doesn't like this from the podium at all. But they wrote the big book. They started writing the big book because in the whole world, they could count 40 sober alcoholics. And they were so thrilled at the miracle that we have that they wanted to put it in a book form. We don't consider it an honor at all to be here. Lamar talked about how he was instructed to clean up the place where they were meeting. This is sad, but you need to hear this. 3 years ago, I picked up a journal from another church, and I read about a regional meeting of their ministers in Oklahoma, and the single biggest topic of discussion at their regional meeting was the damage that meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous was doing to their church rooms. We were burning, leaving cigarette burns on their furniture, we were leaving cigarette burns on their carpets, we were leaving coffee stains in their carpets, we were leaving stains everywhere, there were ashtrays, there were coffee cups everywhere. And I remember what a thrill it was to be able to find any place that would allow us in. You know, this room is fairly full. And we're assuming we belong here, which has taken back my first step. My first step says every one of us who claim to be an alcoholic in this room is powerless over alcohol. And it's like all of us standing in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay or sitting on chairs in the middle of the bay. And because I've been doing it now for 20 years, or Lamar's been doing it for 36, it's not going to be exciting anymore. Supposing, and we're big enough that we probably have people here with HIV positive, and I sure hope you feel fully part of our fellowship wherever you are. But supposing we were a room of people with AIDS, and we heard today that all we had to do not to die of AIDS was to go work with another person with AIDS. And then we heard not only would we not die, our bodies would be healthier than they've ever been before. And we would feel an inner peace we never dreamt had. If we heard there was somebody with AIDS in the lobby, we would kill each other for the right to be the one talking with them. And now it's no joy. No, I don't want to preach. I'm sorry. It's an onus to find an alcoholic and work with them. To relieve another person from the pain that I walked in, or that we walked in. We have such tremendous power. Sunday after Sunday, I look at Christians, and there's nobody home in their eyes. And they're praying, and they're striving, and they're doing everything, and they can't find the peace. They don't. My greatest moment in AA now is when a newcomer, I just use the phrase, it usually happens after the fifth step. When a newcomer's been around a while, not their smile, that's not it, when the first time I look in their eyes and there's someone home. That's our miracle just exploding. We have the power to do that to people. What a great privilege it is. We have a design for living. I couldn't live. I couldn't exist. I wanted not to be. I remember cursing God because I couldn't kill myself, because I couldn't simply will myself out of existence. And today I want to be a cathedral where God dwells. And the design for my living are the 12 steps of our program. And if I'm going to be Larry, if I'm going to have the freedom to be a dandelion today, it's kind of strange. I have to remember the single most important thing in my whole day is not to take a drink. Staying sober has to come before every other thing in my life. I have made other things more important. And as soon as I do that, all of a sudden, I'm ashamed of my color. I'm ashamed of my shape. I'm ashamed of my size. I start losing my peace inside. About 8 years ago now, for the first time in my life, I faced the possibility of really having cancer. I have a close doctor friend. He came into the program a month before I did. And he's the most tactless person I know. He's a tremendous doctor. But I had been turned down 2 out of 3 times going to give blood. I have a rare blood, and I got an ego trip from giving it. And my blood was iron poor. And in between, I started taking iron supplements. And so I went to a meeting where I thought he would be, and I told him this, because he was my doctor for years before I had to move out of town, and after I got back, I had a different doctor. But I would still use him. And I walked up, and I told him all this. And this is what he said. He said, middle-aged man. He said, I don't trust their tests. But if their tests are right, and you got iron poor blood, middle-aged man, that means you have internal bleeding. That means you have cancer of the colon. And he walked away. Hey, it was a beautiful funeral I had planned before I got home. I mean, it was great and everything. Then he said, I don't trust their tests, but I want you off those pills for a week and we'll test your blood again. And incidentally, because I don't tell people this, I forget it. A week later, my blood wasn't iron poor. But during that week, I really had to face the possibility of having one of the forms of cancer because of being anal retentive in the worst, from my mother in many ways, that was the most worst possible way that I could think of dying. For a whole week, I had to remember this was not the most important thing. Staying sober was. And see, I've taken other people's inventories all through my sobriety. I watch what people do so I can learn. And I've been associated with 2 people who have died from cancer in our program. One, when he came down with cancer, the only word, and I hope it doesn't offend you, is he was a total turd. Okay? He was sober about 1.5 years, and he was so bad, people would see his car parked at one AA clubhouse and drive to another. Almost all of our AAs meets in clubhouses in my part of Oklahoma. When he got cancer, from the day he came back from the hospital, for whatever reason, the single most important thing in his life was a newcomer. And I watched him in a wheelchair. He had had the surgery I feared. He was a month away from death, and there was a newcomer there. And when I guess you're dying, you don't have time for any frills, so he didn't have 11 chapters. He picked it up, and he said, the first 7 chapters of this book. And I heard him say it so often that I remember the number of pages. 107 pages has the answer to every problem you have. And he said it with a love you could feel. And he became one of the 10 greatest people I've had the honor of walking with in my life. I knew someone else who had a tremendous program going and walked through several phases of cancer. And the third time it reoccurred, She released every person she sponsored, and I watched her start shriveling. And I watched somebody who was a plum end up as a raisin, not just a prune. She just shriveled inside. And aware of what happened to them, I knew that if I'm going to have a design, if I'm going to live, I've got to remember the most important thing is my not drinking today, and I've got to act on that. Now, if I'm going to have a design for living, I need a power. The second step is so important. It's more than staying sober. How large can my cathedral soar today? You know, what can I be? Can I be a dandelion? Can I live in a dandelion in a world that doesn't want dandelions, and can I know peace? And can that dandelion at the same time be a cathedral? Let me give this a particular. I've started in to see a therapist to work on some deep issues. About 4 years ago, with my sponsor's permission, my meetings haven't changed at all, and my sponsor is still the boss. But through this therapy, I realized something I had never realized. For 53 years, I'm unaware, the first 53 years of my life, I'm unaware of ever having cried once. I remember my mother saying, "You cry and I'll give you something to cry about." And I have 53 years of sorrow in here. And this is not the day I wanted to come out. Waiting to come out. And it would be so simple to say, 53 years old, 18 years in the program, I'm never going to cry. But you see, the second step is a challenge for my looking at people who have the kind of serenity I've seen in the eyes of so many. Jeannie over there, just her eyes are just beaming. I look at that. God's light in your eyes convinces me how much more my God is than I've ever even started to dream yet. And I believe with everything I am that my God's power is stronger than any weakness I've got. And my desire, my God's desire to make me whole is greater than any obstacle I'm going to put in it. And so I believe I will cry. I cried last year in the men's group. And it was neat. Very briefly, but the tears have started to come out. And I cry more over love still than over sorrow. But I'm getting there. And see, if I'm going to say I'm never going to cry, well, then I'm never going to cry. Then I'm going to be building a wall or laying a brick. I'm putting a roof on how tall the building could be. I'm putting limits on what the dandelion can become. And I don't want that. I want to be the full Larry I can be. In order to have my design of living, with 12 years of college, with 4 years of theology, and guess the second speaker... my grades were very good. I'm Phi Beta Kappa too. I go to a guy for 18 years who's never been a Christian. Finally became a Christian 2 years ago, and I thought he was going to become one of these damn fanatics, so I got real worried about it. You know, this is my sponsor. He was never a Christian, never been to college. I don't know that he graduated from high school. And I've been going to him to run my life spiritually as well as everything else for 17, 18 years. And I go to him because for 18 years, I've never gone to him with a problem that God has not given me the answer I need. And I do what he tells me. I've used this example with several people. I've been active in other fellowships, and I had the honor of being asked, and pardon me for talking about it, but it's the best example of how I live what my sponsor tells me. 10 years sober, my sponsor threw me against the wall because I spoke at the podium in his place in a t-shirt and jeans. But he didn't know I was not doing it to dishonor the podium. My sponsor believes, old-fashioned AA, when I stand behind this podium and I know I'm going to be here, I owe it to the program to dress up so that my body talk tells you what I think of this program. Well, he didn't know, but I was doing it that day. My compulsive eating can explode like 4, 5, 6 inches in 4 months, and I was, without being in any way unhealthy, I was the thinnest in a healthy way that I'd ever been in my life. And I wanted to show what can happen by the way I dressed. But he let me know strongly what I'm to do. Now, 6 years later, the Western Regional States of NA asked me to be a speaker at their conference in Cheyenne, Wyoming over the July 4th weekend. And if you don't know it, in NA, tank top is formal dress. So they're all running around in tank top, and I'm running around in coat and tie. But when I dressed to please other people, I died. The dandelion tried to become a rose or a carnation, and I dressed the way my sponsor told me, because when I do what my sponsor tells me, I can start becoming me. When I do what I want or what you want, I'm not going to be me. I know what I'm going to be. And if I'm going to be me, if I'm going to have a design for a living, I got to know who I am. I got to know that I am a dandelion. You know, if I've been raised to think Petunia, then that's what I'm going to think I am. And the fourth step is my looking at me to know my size right now, to know my color and my shape. And it's not going to be something that I like, because I ran from me. I drank in Pennsylvania. I drank in Maryland. I drank in Texas. I drank in Oklahoma. I drank as a teacher. I drank as a priest. I drank as everything. The only constant in all that was me. And so my alcoholism is my running from me. My trying to say, I don't want to be a dandelion. I don't want to be a weed, if that's what you're going to call me. And I can't have peace as long as I say that. I don't like what I see on paper. And periodically I start rejecting who I am. A year ago, my sponsor, my finances were out of shape, and another area of my life, and so my, you can guess what it is, but my sponsor told me to inventory my finances and my sexual life. He just picked them out of the blue. And I delayed doing that inventory longer than any inventory I've ever done. And it's because I didn't want to see this. It's easy for me to believe my own press notices and to figure 20 years sober, I should not have my credit cards run up too much. 20 years sober, I should not still be having problems in the area of sex. I had to see precisely who I was if I was to have peace. Because I can't build my cathedral on your lot. Nor can I build a cathedral that you design on my lot if it's not going to fit on my lot. I got to know what my lot is. Then I went to share my inventory with my sponsor. And one of the most humiliating things, he's on my resentment list in a big way, occurred. As I was reading my sexual inventory to my sponsor, he fell absolutely fast asleep. Can you imagine any more wimpy thing that can happen? I walked around, went to the bathroom, looked at his books. And he doesn't even know where in the inventory he fell asleep. See, if I know I'm a dandelion, I can't have peace until I will allow myself to show myself as a dandelion in the world. If I know I'm a dandelion and I am trying to look, I'm running out of flowers that I know. I don't know a lot of flowers, okay? I'm trying to look as a mum. I think they're shaped a little bit the same. So I'm trying to pretend I'm a mum because that's what you want me to be, but I know I'm a dandelion. There's no peace on that. And in the fifth step, I take everything I am and I go to one other person. And I have the freedom for one brief moment to be me. And that gives me the freedom to be me any time you have a need with absolutely no pain. I can tell you anything that I am if you have a need to hear it. And I've been able to do that. And so the fifth step gives me a great freedom. And many of you have heard of people who have had the great results from doing a fifth step. Let me tell you, my reaction is the opposite. I always leave a fifth step emotionally worse than I came in. And I have learned a lot and been blessed a lot by good Al-Anons. And an Al-Anon friend of mine was the one who said, that's just natural. You've just kicked around all the dirt, the mud's in the pond. Give it a while to settle and it'll be great. And on a Friday here, it'd be like a week and a half after the inventory, the fifth step promise has kicked in. You hear of the promises, please. There are promises all through the big book. There's negative promises. There's promises that guarantee if I do certain things, I will get drunk. The more important than the ninth step promises for me are the fifth step promises. You can be alone at perfect peace and ease. You can look the world in the eye. I had a priest, the other priest in town, who's he's on the bishop's good list, and I'm on the other list, okay? He came by to talk to me. We talked for 10 minutes, and when he left, I hurt so badly for that man. In 10 minutes of talking with me, just the two of us together, no one else in my place, He was never once able to look me in the eye. Could you imagine how the pain the person is in if I'm here and the whole time they're talking, he's talking to me, he's looking here and up and down and shifty-eyed. And I get shifty-eyed, and I get shifty-eyed when I'm not at peace with me, because when I'm not at peace with me, I can't look you in the depth of your soul. And it's time for me to update my inventory. But I walk out feeling worse. And then about a week and a half after the inventory, something happens, and I reach inside and I feel I'm supposed to feel upset. And it's like my insides are a lake. And after every fifth step, that lake gets calmer than it's ever been. And each time I think it's the calmest it can ever be. And that's what happened Friday. I was on a high here. And it was Friday evening doing an inventory that occurred to me, the fifth step promises have come true. I'm alone at perfect peace and ease. I'm a dandelion. You know, I don't give a damn if you don't like it. I give a damn when I don't like it. And all of a sudden, me and my God like who I was. I'm going to tell you my view of the sixth step, and it's very different from anything you've heard, and if it upsets you, this works for me. I thought the sixth step was getting rid of anger. I thought the sixth step was getting rid of fear. I thought the sixth step was getting rid of lust. I told you didn't pick it out of the hat as the second area, okay? You know, it was getting rid of selfishness. I believe that that's psychologically, spiritually, and biologically impossible. I think there is something in life, as my God has created life, that will never want to be less. Pain leads to suicide. Life itself always wants to be more. And I can never want to be less. My sixth step is very different today. My sixth step is entirely ready to have God remove my defects. And my God is a God of love. And if my God is a God of love, a defect in me is anything I won't let God love. And a defect is my compartmentalizing myself and making myself a series of traits. Because you see, you're not dealing with traits. You're dealing with Larry. You're either going to reject me or accept me. And my God doesn't deal with traits, because the doorway to my God is the heart of AA. That's how I find out what my God wants me to know. And it was meditating on how AA accepts me that I understood this. And when I allow my God to love me, I don't have a defect in the world. I can come, or they're moderated. I can come into an AA meeting angry, fearful, and I sit there, and if I share what I am so that you can love the whole person that I am, while I'm with you, all those defects are gone. And love pushes out anger. It's feeling my dignity that allows me to know your dignity and to treat you as a person, not a thing that I'm going to abuse sexually. It's knowing how rich I am inside that makes it unnecessary for me to be greedy and amass more. And my sixth step is my allowing my God to fill me with love, so that I don't need my defects right now. Entirely ready to have God, not Larry, remove them. My seventh step answers a tremendous mystery. And I have nothing to do with this. This is stolen from someone in Oklahoma who cannot say one sentence grammatically correct and has so much wisdom, I just love being around him. Just his eyes beam all the time. His name's Harry. And Harry said, you know, why do we ask God to remove a defect and still have him? And he said, I had one good molar left, and it wasn't feeling right, so I went to see my dentist. And I'm going to tell Harry's story now, because I think I tell it better. I got an ego problem. I got an ego problem, but that's okay. Anyway, now this is in program terms. The dentist opened his mouth, and he said, Harry, your tooth has a defective character. It needs to be removed. And Harry said, told us he loved a good steak so much he was not entirely ready to have the dentist remove that defective character. So he said no thanks and he went home to live with his defect. Well, a while later, he got an abscess in that tooth. It was infected so that he felt his heart beating in his tooth. And the next morning, he was in the dentist's office when the dentist opened, entirely ready to have that dentist remove that defective character. The dentist opened his mouth, took one look inside, and said, "Sorry, you have an infection. Take these pills and come back in 3 days." 3 days later, that tooth was still hurting. The dentist opened the mouth and he said, "Sorry, still hurting. Take these pills and come back in 3 days." 3 days later, the tooth had stopped hurting. Now, this is where Harry and I differ. I wouldn't have been back on the dentist chair. Harry went back and had the tooth removed. Why? Why do I still have defects in my life? Because my God knows they're connected to emotional and spiritual and intellectual infections. And my God says, "Take this meeting and come back in 3 days." I used to never want to share this. This should show you that I should have known this for 15 years. 5 years sober, on my fifth AA birthday, I was drinking, smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I'd been smoking for 30 years. I got good lighters for the first time in my life, and I was looking forward to smoking, and a week after my birthday, I drove 100 miles back to where I sobered up, 140, to celebrate my birthday. It was 11 o'clock at night, I was driving home, I pulled a cigarette out, I was looking forward to smoking, I had 3 packs in the car, and I heard God speak. And the message that I heard, and it wasn't with my ears, and if you've heard God speak, you know it, and if you don't, you can just laugh. But what I heard was, "You don't have to smoke now." And I've never had a cigarette since. I was already working the OA program, so I didn't put an ounce of weight on. I went through no nicotine withdrawal, and I don't smell cigarettes. I laugh at ex-smokers. They're the ones I find funny, because either they're fanatics blowing the smoke away, or they're trying to get a cheap thrill. My God took smoking out of my life as if it had never been there. To show you that I have a real alcoholic mind, about 3 months later, I thought, well, if it's this easy to quit, why don't I just go back, because I can quit whenever I want. And I knew that day that if I quit, I would never be able to smoke again. I'm going to rush ahead and just comment on one or two other steps, and then I'll go to the real cathedral part and get ready to close. If I'm going to be me and really blossom, my design for living must allow me to know you. And I want to talk about half of one step that is often married to another to the detriment of both. I want to talk about the first half of the 8th step. I was able to do it because my greatest AA ever, who died just shortly before his 30th AA birthday, a man named Bob White, when I couldn't do my 8-step lift, said, "Hey, Larry, that step says we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends." Didn't say we became willing to make amends and so we made a list. He said, "You can make a list and you don't ever have to want to make amends." That was the only way I could write. I wrote down people, I wrote down what I did and why I did it. And about a fourth of them I wanted to make amends to. About half of them, there was no damn way I wanted to make amends to. And that last fourth, I wished they were there so I could do it again. But I walked away from that with one of the 4 greatest moments in my AA life. I was astounded to learn you have feelings. And I see, when I'm into my pain, when I've been as abandoned as I've been, it's nearly impossible. I can manipulate your feelings, but I didn't have the power in me to really deal with you as a person, knowing where... I've hurt people trying to do good for them because I didn't know where they were at. And the only way today, talking with you at any time around a table, that I can really be aware of where you're at is by listening carefully. I have a tremendous friend here, and we had an excellent session last night. And he was sharing something with me, and I didn't hear it, because I was in my own head. And we have enough of a friendship that he felt strong enough to tell me, "You're not listening to me, and it's important to me that you hear me." Those aren't the words he used. But I had to back up. And see, I was putting what he was saying into categories, and he didn't fit into those categories. And I had to hear a person. And it was beautiful when I did, because I saw a person, not categories. And my design for living then, the world in which I'm going to live, is so much neater when you can be a tulip, a different color, a different shape, and a different size, and I can be me. I told you I want to build a cathedral because 1 through 10 take away the pain, but they didn't make me feel lastingly okay. They took away the guilt. They took away the loneliness. But they didn't go to the root of my own need. And it's meditation that does this. And my meditations are very simple. I'm going to use the example I've used with you. It's in our 11th step. I'm going to use the prayer of St. Francis as I understand it today. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. And it's God's peace. And I think of God looking at that flower bed. And he's perfect. And he's looking at us. And we're a flower bed right now. And he wants every single one of us here. And there's tremendous... God's at peace with us. We're at war with ourselves and with each other. But God's at peace with us. My God is. And if I feel that, then I can look at you with that same peace. That where there is hatred, I may sow... For me now, I add the word your love. Because I don't have any love to give. Where there's hatred, I may sow your love. I need to feel how my God loves me before I can look at you the same way. I got to see my God looking at this flower bed, looking at Larry the dandelion, and loving me. My God has total acceptance for who I am. That where there's doubt, I may sow your faith. At an AA meeting where there was great love one day, I went into a meditation. I stepped away from the meeting, and I experienced the reality that my God has absolute faith that I'm going to be Larry. See, God can't fail. No matter how that dandelion wants to open up into a tulip, God knows it's going to open up into a dandelion. God has, and that's what he wants. He has absolute faith that I'm going to be me. That where there's despair, I may sow your confidence. He can't lose. He sowed the seed. The power's in him. I can't frustrate what he wants me to be. I'm going to be a dandelion. And every time I get worried, he chuckles. And I can feel that in this meditation. God looking at that, you know, at us here. We're going to be us. No matter how much you try to be me, you're not going to do it. You're going to only be you. Where there's darkness, I may sow your light. I saw myself as totally black, ugly, inside to the core. And God looks at me, and I'm part of the beauty of that whole picture. And at moments, I touch that light, and I know I am who God wants me to be. I don't do everything God wants me to do, but that doesn't strip the dignity of who I am. See, my home was one in which I was accepted for what I did, not for who I was. My God accepts me for who I am, and I know to the depth of my being there's nothing I can do that will cause my God to stop forgetting who I am. I'm his kid. And where there's sadness, I may sow your joy. I'm sad on me at times. I hate it. And God just looks with joy. I've got to these by one meditation is I'll picture me and my God sitting at a table for two in a restaurant. And God just looks at me. And I feel what's in God's heart. And all of these feelings have come through. I'm trying to put words on miracles that have happened in my life. And step by step, I'm experiencing how my God looks at me. And then I can give it to you. Once in this, my God reached over and touched me. And that was the most upsetting moment in the meditation. I could allow God to love me. I could allow God to have faith in me. I could allow God to have hope in me. But it was still hard to have God like me. Really like me as I am today. This is the power we have. You know, I went to alcohol and I found a design for living. And I wouldn't be here if it didn't fail. But my alcoholism progressed to the point where I don't have a choice. Alcohol stopped working. And if I go out, I know that I'm hopeless again. I can't be me, and alcohol will just hate me, help me hate what I am even more. And I have an alternative, and I have a program, and I have a fellowship, and I have a purpose. See, I told you I'm a cathedral. A cathedral is a place, if you just use the term, where God and man meet. And if I allow God's love in me, and I allow myself to be me, I allow you to meet God in me. And what more could I want? I went through midlife crisis in the program. And I went through midlife crisis because I got a terrible assignment. I thought I was hopeless. And I was a failure and useless. And I'm sharing this because this is a young people's. And God willing, you'll live long enough and you'll all go through midlife crisis. And the answer to it is the 11 and 12 steps of the program. When I experience God loving me, I am not a failure. And I believe I'm living today because there's one alcoholic here who needs me to be their cathedral, to be the place where they meet God in some little way in their life. And as I told you, if I could reach in you and take out from you The pain I lived with my whole life is a success. Thoughts come to me, two thoughts, and I guarantee I'm done. If you died today and you came before you as God, how would you pass on your life? Would you pass you or fail you? 35 years old, I'd have failed me completely. Today I pass me, because I know an alcoholic who died sober, and I was the first one she talked with, and she went on a cloud nine that never ended. Her dying sober, if she's the only one I ever helped, make my all the air I've breathed worthwhile. I have taken one person out of my own pain, kind of pain. Ask yourself that, and then how would you grade yourself? When I sobered up, and this is my ending now, Jonathan Livingston Seagull was very popular, the book. And I was privileged to be at a young people's in Whitney, Texas. And a young man, a cyclist, a biker, was celebrating his second birthday in Levi's, tattoos and all the other stuff that go with it. And he cried, and he read a portion of Jonathan. And boy, he added so much to my life. He and I are good. We've been out of touch now, but we're good friends. Jonathan is a gull that believes we can be more than we are. We can fly higher than we've known. And he gets persecuted for it. But finally he comes back and he starts making some converts. And all of a sudden, Maynard comes limping across the sand to Jonathan. And this is the story. And Maynard has a broken wing. And he looks at Jonathan. And Jonathan says, "What do you want?" And Maynard says, "I want to fly like you do." And Jonathan says, "You can fly as high as you want to." And Maynard says, "You don't understand. I have a broken wing." And Jonathan says, "You can fly as high as you want to." And this biker cried, reading this. I came to you. You came to us. I didn't have a broken wing. I had at least 4 or 5 addictions running. I had broken wings and broken legs. I couldn't even crawl. And you asked me, "What do I want?" And I said, "I want to fly." And you told me I can fly as high as I want to. And I started telling you why I couldn't. You told me I could fly as high as I want to. I've been soaring for years. I hope you do too. Thank you.
I want to thank Larry for a really good meeting, and on behalf of the Mickey Paul Committee, we'd like to present him with a small gift.